Turn on the welcome to another episode of the Carpcast Extra. How's it going, Mark?
It's going good. A bit of a rush to get home, but I'm here. I'm all nice and calm, sat down in the spare room. Well, I like to call it my podcast studio, but it's now my wife's Lego room. She stole it.
And it was your cat's snoring room. I noticed a minute ago. He's got the loudest purr.
Yeah, she's about 17 years old, that one. And when she really starts purring, which she does, you look at her when she starts purring, she gets loud. She also drools.
Yes.
Lovely cat, nice temperament, but just not great. Especially when you're trying to get to sleep and she likes to jump on the bed and start snoring and drooling in your ear hole.
So, moving on. What questions are we asking our celebrity guest this week?
Well, this episode, yes. We've got the game changer, you know, that moment or that item that makes the difference. And also, along similar lines, the don't leave home without it item. You know, I was doing these, I found them very interesting and surprising, a few of them as well. I'm sure everyone will enjoy them.
Yeah, it's game changers, an interesting one, because I had a definite, not an epiphany, but a definite change in my fishing. Having just written the first couple of chapters of the book that I'm going to do, it's an e-book and a normal book, it was quite interesting that I wanted to get the point across that, like, literally anybody could have caught the fish that I caught. You know, I was just a keen angler who fished for a long, long time as a kid, never fished anywhere that had any big fish. You know, I spent years to catch my first double. I spent even longer to catch my first 20 because I didn't fish any waters that had 20s in. Obviously, the first water I fished that had 20s, I caught them. I actually caught my first 30 out of that water. But I was still a noddy, if you know what I mean. I still just complete recreational, go fishing for fun when I can. I mean, I was addicted to it, you know. I went as often as I could. But the game changer for me was when I joined Wireside. And just fishing, like, I still went as a noddy angler. I remember, you know, people that later became my friends, the Northwest sort of serious anglers, your Roger Bacons, you know, Eddie, Jason, you know, a few of the lads were very serious about the fishing and quite competitive. I wasn't. I mean, I caught one of the most sought after fish on my first session on a day ticket, and I looked at Noddy, my rods are all up in the air compared to theirs, and you know, it's just I'd moved from down south up north, so it was kind of, you know, you fit into what's going on in your lake. You know, if on your local lake everyone's using two rods tightly close together and, you know, the rod tips right by the water, or however people fish, you tend to adapt to that environment, don't you? You tend to, like, tweak your stuff. You're the only one with, like, your butt's really low and your rod tip's really high and the line shooting out across the water, and everyone else has got it the opposite way around. It doesn't take long, or a few little friendly ribs or whatever, before you change. So fishing that water, it was a completely different, because it was long range fishing and a lot longer range than I was comfortable casting. So I ended up having to change my tiny little reels and me soft 2¼-pound through action rods. And but, you know, I still didn't take a camera fishing, not a proper camera. I mean, this is pre mobile phones as well, having cameras on them. I think there were mobile phones around then, but they didn't have cameras. And I remember catching I think it was called the Big Lin, like a mid-30 linear. It was one of the sort of A team in there on this first ever session. And, you know, they're all on the other side of the lake. Later found out, you know, they're like, oh, day ticket duffer, you know, turned up, fluked one of the big ones, as used to happen on there quite a lot. You know, rods all over the place up in the air. And I remember one of them coming around taking the picture. Obviously, I didn't know him at the time. And, you know, as a few, as I got to know him over the next few weeks, there were a few friendly jibes and stuff. And it was like, you know, I hadn't really used a marker float up till that point. And it was the lake that changed the game for me. It made me take it a lot more serious. You know, I bought a decent camera to, you know, they couldn't believe that you catch one of the sought after fish. I never even used to take pictures of my fish before that. The two biggest fish that I just mentioned, the 20 and the 30 that I caught out of Woburn Sands, which is my first 20, my first 30, I didn't have a camera with me. I had to go and find a phone box, because this was pre-mobile phones. I had to go and find a phone box, ring my girlfriend, who drove half an hour to the lake to take a picture for me. And that, I think I've told this story before in the normal carp cast, actually. I caught a 27, which was smashed my PB by a mile. I think it was the second biggest fish in the lake at the time. Again, I wasn't fishing for target fish. I just joined the lake and fished it for whatever was in there, you know. And wild fishing, it's like, oh, there's a bigger one in here called whatever. And then she came over. She came out of college because it was like 9 a.m. in the morning in the autumn. Drove, took the picture. She probably had been gone 10 minutes when my other rod went, and I'd caught the biggest fish in the lake, scaly, at like 31 pound. I had to wait for her to get home to ring her to get her to come back again to take another picture, and she didn't want to come. She's like, you've got a picture of the other one, what do you need a picture of this one for? I was like, it's a 30 pound carp, you know. She didn't know anything, but you know. And I still didn't take a camera fishing even after that for many years. It was this fishing wire side, and it was the game changer. It was seeing better anglers, seeing how seriously some of these guys took their fishing, and actually thinking about what I was doing instead of just, you know, seeing a rig in a magazine, tying it up, casting it out, catching fish sometimes, not catching fish other times, you know, really fine tuning everything. And it was the lake that did it. It was a definite change in how I approached fishing. And you know, then I got really analytical about rigs, and you know, I was hungry for knowledge. I was taking in everything, and then I ended up joining, you know, it's because of that I met Jason. We ended up buying an Elstow 2 ticket and going down and fishing for the mother, which is where I met you, and which again was a pretty serious low stock lake. But at that point I just wanted to catch big fish. So the game changer for me was joining that lake and meeting those other serious anglers. Imagine if you lived somewhere like the Colne Valley and you jumped on Harefield in the late 80s, or, you know, just something like that. You would be a different angler probably today than what you are now. Do you agree?
I know, yeah. I mean, everything you said there, I was just going through my own mind, and I can relate to it almost to the words, just different lakes, different people. You know, again, round about the same time, followed you, I think I was at Pit 2 before you, but it was, you know, meeting people like a fellow I know I've mentioned on the main cast before, a lad called Sean Ong. He'd been, I think it was about 95, he was travelling from York to Yateley. He had several from the car park, including the Dustbin and Heather. And, you know, what a lovely fella, but also watching how efficient he is. And the main thing, the drive. You know, then it was getting down to Elstow 2 and, you know, become obsessed myself and just catching that very first fish from Elstow 2. I think that was a game-changing moment. It was, wow, I can do this. I can catch these carp. And then that was it. It was driven. Although, I'd just say a little bit of a game change. I'll bring it a bit more up to date. Was last year. Because I've never been a great zig angler. I'll be fishing the Folly. And that is a great zig water. And I did catch a couple out of there on zigs. And I'm going on to Monk's Pit this year, as long as the bank account allows me, that is. But that's another great zig water. And I'm going on to that with a hell of a lot more confidence to sit behind three pieces of flip-flop mid-water than ever before. And I'm really looking forward to it. So, you know, just a small one in the general scheme of things. But you know, I've got my mind set on Zig, something we I think we both should have done a long time before, and who knows, we may have caught more fish doing it. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, if we'd have fished, you know, one of the lakes that, you know, the early Ziggers were fishing on, if you happened to be fishing that lake at the time, Ziggs would have probably been an important part of your armoury many years ago. I mean, I remember 10 years ago talking about sliding Ziggs, adjustable Ziggs on, when we had an Elstow 1 ticket, you know, and we, I don't think we ever dared use them, but we knew it was right for the place at the time, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, there was, remember the, what's that swim at the top end, the Ants?
Hmm.
You know, you didn't have much features apart from margins in front of you, a lot of deep water, you know, 20 foot plus. But you would regularly see the fish up there. You know, they'd regularly be nutting out up there. They'd pass through that area to get into the reed swim. And, you know, especially in winter, because, do you remember rightly, it was always seemed to be up that end of the lake. I mean, did you speak to this about with Martin Clark? Because I know he's done it before. Surface caught fish in the depths of winter. It was always seemed to be over really deep water as well. If you just sat all winter casting Ziggs out there, what would the results have been?
Certainly, yeah. Hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Oh, God, so is it. Hindsight? If we're talking about hindsight, if we'd have known about the Chodrig on pit two.
Wow, yeah.
Over that onion weed.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, I had that thought on a short stint on the Scout Lake. Ended up fishing a Chodrig with just... it was about 3 foot of heavy lead core and no lead. You know, you can still flick it maybe about 15 yards, and that was just laying on top of the Canadian weed. And this Canadian weed was coming within, you know, 2-3 foot of the surface in, it was 10 feet of water. So you put a lead on, it's just going to sink whatever rig out of sight. But without the lead on, your lead core just laid there, and it never did me a fish, but then... I only ever caught one fish in 30-odd nights from there. It was a ridiculously hard lake, but it's certainly a valid tactic and one that's in the memory banks, and one I'll be using again if the situation arises.
Certainly. Well, let's have a listen to somebody else's game changer. It's Steve Briggs.
I don't know about a eureka moment. I mean, there's definitely things that have happened over the years. There's certain changes... I've sort of stumbled across or found somehow that have made a difference at the time. I can remember years ago, I mean, when I first started using like the hinge stiff rig, you know, that was certainly a real game changer for me. And I've used that, I still use it today, and it's held me in good stead, that rig. You know, it's a real good pop-up rig. And obviously, I was fishing up at Farlow's at the time when I started using it, and I was sort of catching 2 or 3 fish a weekend on bottom baits and snowmans and things like that. And I remember starting chucking out these pop-ups on the hinge stiff rig, and all of a sudden I was catching like 10 or 12 carp a weekend. You know, the difference was amazing. You know, and it wasn't really a flash in the pan. That rig has carried on working all through the years for me. And it's, you know, I don't use it all the time, but every now and then I go back to it and it still does the job, you know. So that's certainly been a good one for me. But to be honest, like when you talk about sort of game changers, I think it's been quite a gradual thing for me over the years, just to get all the rubbish out of my mind that surrounds carp fishing and rigs and baits and all that. It took me a lot of years to simplify everything, and simplifying everything has certainly made a whole load of difference to my fishing. You know, I'm a lot more consistent on a lot of different waters these days because I fish a lot simpler. And, you know, years ago, I used to get caught up in all the rig and the bait things. And, you know, I see it in loads and loads of other people now. You know, they ask me questions about rigs and baits. And I see myself in that years ago. And you know, and I try to tell them, you're looking at the wrong things. You're going down the wrong paths. It's not about the rigs. You know, it's carp fishing is a lot about what's in your own mind. But telling that to someone and actually believing it yourself is a totally different thing, you know. And it's that those years of experience that gradually changed me from sort of feeling comfortable. You know, I now feel comfortable about what I'm doing. It doesn't matter where I go or what water I fish, a carp is a carp. And I use a quite a simple, you know, good quality bait, but quite a simple approach. And, you know, that has held me in more good stead than anything else. You know, I found a simple but effective method of just fishing without overcomplicating things. And when you get to that stage, for me, you know, I can sit on a lake, and if I'm not catching, I know it's not my rig, I know it's not my bait, so it's something else. You know, the fish aren't there or they're not feeding, but that makes the whole job a lot easier because it narrows down what I've got to do. I know my bait works, so, you know, it's not the bait, it's not the rig, I've just got to find the fish. And so, you know, that way, it's quite simple. All those years when, like, I'd blank, and then I'd go back next weekend with a different bait because I was sure the bait was wrong and things like that, that just sends you round and round in circles and just confuses you more and more. But, like I say, you know, at the time, I just didn't realise it. It's taken those years to make me realise that. So the game changer has been a long process of time and experience, I would say. So it's not an instant thing, but, you know, it's something I've had to go through, and I'm pleased I've gone through it and come out the other side.
So a big thank you to Steve Briggs. What do you make of that, Mark?
Very interesting. I think that's something a lot of people I know, certainly myself, can relate to. Because we all seem to go around these, you've called them the wobbles in the past, where these doubts creep in after a couple of blanks, which realistically are probably no fault of your own. Then you start thinking, I mean, is my bait working? Am I using the wrong rigs? You know, wrong hooks, wrong this, wrong that. And you start changing things and, you know, going round and round in circles and basically disappearing up your own backside. And just getting that out of your mind, getting the clutter out and sticking, having 100% confidence in what you know works, and what you know, if the fish are playing ball, if the weather's right, if it's going to happen, if they're feeding, they're going to eat your bait, they're going to get hooked on that rig, and you're going to land them. You know, just having faith in your watercraft as well. And getting the clutter out, having faith is the key. And I can certainly relate to Steve Briggs' game changer there. And if I remember rightly, I did ask him when we recorded if any of that came through fishing with Simon Crow. Because if you've, you know, listened to Simon Crow or read any of his articles, you'll know he's quite possibly one of the most, rig-wise anyway, basic anglers out there. But he catches a ton of fish. In fact, I'd put him up there with Terry Hearn and Dave Lane. He really is that good, that driven. And he works full-time. And look at all the fish he's caught.
Mm. Yeah, the frame of mind thing's very important, because I remember, probably told this before as well, but fishing Colmere, which was like the mega low stock, super tricky, 90 acre lake in Shropshire, fishing for fish that I didn't even know were there at this point. I hadn't seen a fish. I'd done about 30 nights leading up to Christmas, hadn't seen anything, pulled off for the winter, came back in like March, when the weather was started warming up again. I remember the first session getting down there thinking, I'm determined not to set up somewhere until I see a fish. Anyway, I've got there at first light. I've spent 8 hours walking the lake. I've not seen, you know, a bubble. Not seen anything anywhere. I remember ringing one of my pals up, and I was like, he's like, yeah, come down here to whatever lake he was fishing on. Get yourself down to Dead Man's or something. I'm like, no, this is where I'm fishing. I'm not going to give up. But I felt like I was absolutely wasting my time. I've never felt so despondent. You know, I got there full of hope, you know, started the new season, the weather's warming up. And I made myself fish. I was just like, well, I'm just going to pick a swim. And I went through the motions for a couple of days, 2 or 3 days. And it was during that session, I thought, I'm going to do a baiting campaign. Like, I'm going to engineer the odds in my favour, as opposed to just let the fish, you know, show me, or, you know, I hadn't seen one in 30, 40 nights prior to Christmas, so I wasn't holding out much hope of seeing one now. But I thought, right, well, let's not wait for it to happen, let's make it happen. And and I came up with the idea that session. Just, it was, would have been so easy to get back in there, you know, because all the gear was still in the motor. Would have been so easy just to get back in and drive home. I mean, I didn't even know there were any carp in there for sure. Only rumours at this point. But, you know, that determination that, you know, I'm not going to be beaten, not taking the easier option of just, you know, because obviously I love fishing, I wanted to go fishing, you know, I could have easily gone and fished with my mates for a couple of days and maybe I wouldn't have caught those fish. Sometimes it is just a frame of mind, it's having that mindset of you know, I'm going to see this through.
You've just hit the nail on the head with the seeing it through. I mean, I remember fishing hard lakes and it does get tempting to have a social with your mates or just after a long blank going to get a few runs somewhere, but you're not going to catch the one that you really want fishing somewhere else. You know, it's all good fun, and if you want to do that, do it. But it is going, you have to be driven, you have to be, get the blinkers on and be single-minded. You know, even when you're not going to catch, you're either catching or you're learning. I read that somewhere and I thought it was good and I'm going to use it, so I just did.
I've seen that quote a few times recently on Facebook, actually.
That's probably where I saw it.
We never lose, we win or we learn. It's a quote I saw, which it applies. It was in a poker thingy, but yeah, it's quite true, I think. As long as you do learn, you know, as long as you, even if it's just a process of elimination, of ruling out areas that you, maybe you have wasted a session fished in an area and couldn't really find any nice spots and it's stinky silt and it looked a bit dead. Like, you've still learned something to rule that area out, you know. And that's, we've spoke about this before when we're choosing a lake and we're deciding, you know, where to fish. Quite often I'll pick a swim in each area of the lake that I fancy and rule out a lot of areas as well. Like, I'll try and narrow the lake down in the first couple of sessions to areas that I'm going to focus on. You know, for whatever reason, you see stuff there, or, you know, there's better features in one swim than, you know, the swims either side of it. So if I'm going to fish that area, I'll fish the swim with the better features. Or, you know, just ruling areas out is as important as you know, picking the right areas. Let's hear from Chili.
A game-changing moment. Right. I am not the greatest advertiser in the world. You know, I work for two companies. I have worked for them for a very, very long time. And that loyalty is good for me. It's good for the company, but I think that that loyalty is, most of all, is good for the guy on the street who has to go in and buy the stuff. I'm not jumping around from company to company trying to make a few dollars more and just thinking of myself. I think the guy on the street is the person that keeps me doing the things that I love doing so much. However, one of the biggest, or the biggest game changer, I think, for me, happened in 1994 when I met Keith Jenkins and Dave Lane. And obviously that was my introduction to mainline baits. And by hook or by crook, I'd managed to wrestle a big tube, 10 key of the original Grange it was. And I was fishing a lake that it could be easy, but it could be very, very tricky. And it hadn't done a bite for a couple of weeks. And Keith had left me this bait. And I went over there. And for whatever reason, I still really don't gather why I did it. I found a couple of fish. You know, I saw some signs of fish in one of the corner swims. And I put 9 kilos of that bait out there. They were 15 mil baits, the most body I'd ever put in a lake. And for a lake that hadn't done a bite for 2 or 3 weeks, I had 11 fish that night up to low 30s. And all of them were depositing lots of bait on the mat. And I think from that day until this, to me, the most important thing in carp fishing, you can cast out single baits and a little bag and nick a bite. I don't want to nick a little bite. I want to nick loads of bites. And the best way of doing that is using your bait effectively. And that taught me such a lesson. And yeah, I've never looked back. I use a fair bit of bait where I can. And I've used the same company's bait for the past 24 years, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, that's something I'd overlooked from Chile. Bait, some for me, this is not a Nash advert, I wouldn't be saying it, you know, I've used lots of baits for years, used mainline, I used Nutra baits, you know, caught on all of them. But getting the Scopex squid from Nash was a game changer for me. It just gave me that, you know, maybe it's not any better than any of the other baits I've just mentioned, but it gave me confidence. I'd removed one doubt from the session, if you know what I mean. I caught straight away as soon as I started using it. I caught every time that I thought I should have caught, and more, you know. I caught extraordinary results, and just having that confidence, I mean, that's a game changer, isn't it? I think having something that you're 100% sure when you cast it out, if a fish comes across it, they're going to pick it up.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I had the same sort of thing. Again, not with the Scopex squid, but you remember the Scopex squid plus, which had a bit of tiger nut flour in?
Yeah.
Yeah, because when we joined pit two, this seemed it was either daft yellow pop-ups cast a showing fish or particles.
Yeah.
So I mean, my first order was 30 kilo of that stuff. And I'll be honest, I wasn't overly confident in it. So first time I went down, I had it with me. I just carried on fishing my usual particles, my tiger nuts. But I baited a few margin spots with this Scopex Squid Plus, so I could see them, you know. There's nothing that gives you more confidence than actually watching a carp with your own eyes sucking the bait up. I did one lap of the lake, I got back round to where I put the bait, and guess what?
What?
No, it was still there. But about half an hour later, yeah, the water was milk, and there was, I think it was about four or five fish, and they had absolutely smashed the lot. And I can't remember catching another fish on tiger. I can't remember using it much more, but, you know, I caught on the Scopex Squid Plus from there. And I'd much rather use boilies than particles any day of the week. So much, it's not as messy for a start. I mean, if you have long hair and you try spotting a load of emp and sludge out, it's messy. Give me a catapult and some boilies any day.
Let's move on. It's always nice to hear the happy tones of Ian McMillan.
Okay, my greatest edge in carping, or my greatest my game-changing moment. I suppose they go hand in hand, really. And my greatest edge, I think, is mobility and the willingness to adapt and be able to execute what I think I need to do. And I think that comes from years of getting it wrong. But it also comes with years of fishing a lot of different pressured circuit lakes, where if you don't step up to the plate, you get left behind. Because, again, it's not just you against the carp, it's you against the anglers. And that's what used to thrive me and used to drive me on. You know, I'd think nothing of driving three and a half hours to put up with the crowd. Now it's a different story than what I want from my fishing. But I have to learn, and I do watch other people. I don't watch other people to copy them with their rigs and things like that. I watch how other people do it on my very first sort of few sessions on any new lake, and I think the regulars can tell you a lot. And I remember going to the Essex Manor, and I'd sort of been on to Frimley and moved from Welly to Frimley and sort of Frimley to Monks, and I thought, I'll go down, I'll chat down the town on the Essex Manor. So I've done a bit of research. It's only a small place, very, very busy. Irrigation pits are quite deep, no real Canadian, lots of reeds, but a lot of silkweed. And, you know, you think, well, I'm not going to go with anything radically different because what I do works everywhere else. So I remember setting up, and I met some really, really good lads down there, and I'm still friends with a lot of them now. Very good etiquette, very, very good thing, because it was only small. You couldn't have dickheads on there who were casting all over the place, because it just would upset the whole syndicate vibe. So I think I wasted probably, I don't know, 6 to 9 nights by doing it my own way. Because the thing is, with silkweed, you get a drop when it goes through it. Even if you're using a little lead, your lead will still touch down, and it almost blinkers your vision that you're fishing, because you think, bang, it's cracked down, that's perfect, I'm leaving it. On a gravel pit, that is what you want. But this is the Essex Manor. So consequently, I'd leave my rods out and I'd reel them in perhaps a day or a night later, and they're smothered in silkweed. And you look back and you think, I've wasted a whole session by getting it wrong with the drop. And also, a lot of the lads were moving around because it was so busy, and the fish would find sanctuary even in one empty swim because there was no lines there. And I remember it was Richie Loftad and Dan, a couple of lads down there. And I didn't take masses of gear. Bearing in mind on Wellington, I've been more of a bait and wait guy. 72 hours, put a load of bait out. I was confident because I knew the lake well, that I'll cast. So I didn't take masses of gear, but they were actually laughing at me on my second session when I packed up, saying how much kit I took. And I thought, bollocks to this. I'm not having them laughing at me. So I remember getting home and stripping all my van out, putting it on the patio. And I did we've all got them where I might need that. I'll just take that just in case. So I managed to strip it back, and I thought, right, if I haven't used it for a month, I'll leave it in my van. So like your floater kit and all that sort of rubbish, spare lead. So I stripped it right back, and I was amazed of what I could actually take. You didn't need a marker rod on the Essex Manor because you weren't looking for sort of gravel areas, or you could find them with your fishing rod. You were just looking for signs of fish and a better drop, if anything, but there's definitely better drops there than others in the silkweed. And so, of course, I've gone back the week after, and I suppose the game-changing moment was my introduction to the Chodrick. So not only had I become this mobile angler, that I got so obsessed that I think at times I moved too much. When you just want to practice an art form until you've perfected it? That's what I found myself doing. I found myself almost moving and timing myself and seeing how quick I could get from one side of the lake to the other. And I was only small, but you've still got to pack down. And because of my OCD, I couldn't just chuck the gear on my barrow. I had to place it, and it had to have some sort of rhythm to it. I remember it was Kodak, a lad named Kodak, Mark Dean, his name, a very, very accomplished angler from down Kentway. And he would come over to see me and see Johnny Miller and some of the other lads. And he was big into chod fishing. I'm probably going back to 2007, 2008. And I remember on this second session where I'd reeled my rigs in again and they were smothered in silkweed. And he's going, "And you've got to get on this chod rig, Tom." And I'm like, I said, "Yeah, but Kodak, what I do works. It works everywhere else, blah, blah, blah." And he said, and this was in its very, not early stages, but it wasn't as well documented, far from it, from what it is now. And so I remember I didn't have any bits to tie Choddy's mark. I had no outturned eyes. I had no size outturned eyed hooks. I had no size 11 swivels. I had no beads. I had no nothing because I didn't use it, I just didn't use the chod rig or the helicopter rig. I was very much a lead clip, find my spot, stick to him. So basically, I've gone beg, stealing and borrowing around the manor trying to get bits, much to the amusement of everybody. "You're a sponsored angler, you must have loads." I'm like, "I haven't got no chod bits." And I'd moved swims, and I'd watched these fish patrolling a swim called Mums. And I sort of tied this chod rig up, and looking back, you couldn't use lead core on the manor, so it had to be naked. And looking back, this thing was probably, 5 inches tall, looked like a pig's dick, it's got curves in it and all sorts, very poorly tied. So I flirted it out down to the right-hand side. Within 10 minutes, bang, I think out of mid-30. And I'm thinking, "Oh my God, this chod rig's, this isn't bad. You can almost chuck it anyway. You still feel it for a drop." But it enabled me to start presenting in areas that I knew were quite heavily silkweeded. And I went away, I did another afternoon, another night, pulled off in the morning, and I had 3 carp. And when that again, that light bulb comes on, and you think, and I looked, started to look, when I was driving home, I was looking back at all the years fishing on places like Welly and Frimley and Monk's Pit and other waters that I've been on and down at Lynch, and thinking, my God, how many more fish would I have caught if I could just opportunally cast a choddy into light weed or sometimes heavier weed and get a bite, because it's the only presentation that you can fish effectively in. And I think that was, it's a double-edged sword. Not only is my greatest edge in carping now the fact that I will move at the drop of a hat, the game-changing moment for me was my introduction to the chod rig. And yes, it's massively overused now, and I don't use them so much now at all, because they're so massively overused. But my God, when I first got into it, I was so confident, and it totally transformed not only how I look at lakes, still do look at lakes now, but how I change my approach to carp fishing in every single way, from being quite static to being really conscious about what gear I take and my willingness to move. And there was something Daryl Peck said to Richie Lofthouse on the matter when I've started to be like this, and he said he's dangerous, Tongas, when he's like this. And I'll never ever forget that. And for somebody like Pecky to say that, who even though I'm now mobile, Pecky runs rings around most people. I've never seen anybody so mobile as Pecky. But for him to say that, I think that's as much of a compliment as I ever get out of Daryl, and I'll never forget that. So, definitely that was my greatest edge and game changing moment, all in one foul swoop.
Right. I would say it's not going to be an item of tackle, which might surprise you. It's going to be my attitude. Because of the matches, I learned to absolutely never give up. Ever, ever, ever stop trying. And that, in my life, has been my biggest edge. Because whereas I see people's confidence sapping or, whiling away, I will just change things around. I'll tip the tackle box out, change things around, and most of the time, invariably, I'll get a bite. So my biggest edge in my world is not a single bit of tackle or a sharper hook or this or that. It's my ability to chop things around, change it a second's notice, and try harder than most do around me. So, and that's stood me in good stead over the years. And that goes from matches to day tickets to syndicate walkers that are rock hard. Never give up. Absolutely. If I'd have sat there, last week I was on Horton. Now, I only caught a little fish, but I've sat there, it's beating me up, Horton, at the moment. I've done six nights now for one bite, but I sat there watching these fish right on the other side of the lake, and it's so easy, Mark, and it's a thing. Someone else will go down there soon and have a result. And in all fairness, I rung Lee Wagner on the other bank because he couldn't quite see him. I said, mate, if you're staying, three swimmers to your left, round the corner, they're leaping. And he went, I've got to go. So I thought, oh, bloody hell, well, I'll go round. Because it is, we've all done it, Mark. We've all been lazy. And I thought, no, fair enough. So I put on my little rig that I do when I'm flinging in the edge out and went round there, and 20 minutes later, I had a 20.5-pound mirror. Which, out of Horton, he's a baby, but it's still an achievement to get the bite. So the fact that I actually bother is my biggest edge over probably 60 or 70% of the anglers that I meet on the bank. So there you go. My biggest edge is me, my mindset.
Wise words indeed from Mr. Ian Russell, and obviously Mr. Tong, Ian McMillan before that. Never give up. That is... that's something that I've been guilty of. I mean, Ian alluded to the match fishing there, and when you kind of have to, the couple of matches I've done, exactly that's happened. You don't give up, but that little competitive edge there, and makes you, put that zig on for the last 2 hours, where normally I'd think, right, I'm going to make a brew and I'm just going to have a slow pack up. If you're in a match situation, you're going to try for that last hour or do one last lap round the lake, see if you can find some bait that's vanished in the edge that maybe you've put in before. So, just not giving up, just determination. I mean, sometimes you want to go fishing and chill, and sometimes you really want to maximise the time that you have. And Paul Harris, we spoke about Paul Harris before, but Paul Harris, who we met in Elstow, he used to get 24 hours fishing every week. He used to arrive at first light on a Tuesday morning, and he used to fish all day, all night, and go home the next day. Now, I was doing three nights a week on a very low stock lake, sort of session fishing and having a completely different approach. And Paul had fished three swims sometimes in that 24 hours. He ended up catching the mother. He had the same amount of fish, well, close to the same amount of fish as I had. I mean, he fished most weeks, but he fished for a fraction of the time that I fished on each week, and he made the most of it. I remember him having a fish called Lisa off the top on a red hot day, where Mark and I had gone and had a walk around another lake. It was hot. We thought we'd go and try and spot some fish on the surface elsewhere. And in the meantime, Paul caught a fish out of pit two that we'd kind of written off. So, never give up.
I think my greatest edge in carp fishing really has been determination. I fish some difficult waters in my time, but I always have it in my head. I've always had it in my head that if carp were that clever, we wouldn't cast out an 18 millimetre boilie in all them gallons of water and catch them, you know. Yeah. So I always have it in my mind, they're hard, but they're not impossible, you know. And and some of the water, I mean, some of the waters I fished and you fished, it's you know, you're guaranteed to catch carp, but yeah. Some of them, they're headbangers of a place, but I think the main thing is not giving up, you know, not giving up and just keep on trying. Never give up, never stop trying, in other words, is my motto for a while, you know. And yeah, that's where, just the determination and, you know, determination to do well. You know, I very rarely give up on something, you know, until I've achieved what I want to achieve, you know.
Have you ever left a lake without kind of finishing it, you know, when you've had the option to? Was that it? You just can't fish anywhere else until you've caught what you need to catch?
No, I've definitely, I mean, the only lake I left, I mean, after catching two-tone, the only lake I left because it wasn't viable, really. If, you know, the distance I lived from the lake, you know, and the fishing hours I had to fish, it wasn't viable for me to continue to fish. It was St Ives Lagoons, like fishing for the fat lady.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did find that difficult, but the main thing was, well, I did catch carp out of it. I caught a couple of carp out of it in, you know, a couple of sessions, yeah, or two or three sessions, and but I just couldn't fish long enough hours on there to sort of, you know, I had to walk away from it. You know, I mean, again, that was a fish that used to get caught fairly regular, and yeah, I never got obsessed with it. You know, but no, I think that, I mean, the main thing is, and I don't, one thing I don't do as well, we fish for carp and we teach carp. So, you know, I never get hoodwinked into thinking this is the method, this is the bait. You know, I always know, you know, that I've got to ring the changes sometimes. You know, if you walk around the lake and ask everyone to reel in their rods and measure their hookling, they're probably all around about 9 inches, 12 inches long, you know, yeah, something like that. So I would always use something, try to use something. It's a little bit different. It might only be something like that, you know, like a longer hookling, shorter hookling, you know, a bottom bait when they're all usually pop-ups and things like that. Because, I mean, you know, that's one thing I do. I'm not a massive pop-up user, to be honest with you, because I always think, you know, every free offering we fire out in the lake, it lands on the bottom, you know. And so, yeah, I think sometimes, you know, people use a pop-up for the sake of it, and, you know, they think it stands out more, which it does, but equally, I think on some of the waters I fish, it signals alarm bells, you know, because the carp are, you know, I ain't touching that, you know, it's just not actually natural. And another thing I don't do, I very rarely ever do, is put dips, use a dip, you know, because you see a lot of it. I mean, I work in a very busy tackle shop, the Tackle Box, and you know, lots and lots of anglers, they got to buy the boilies, the 18 mm boilies, 40 mm boilies, whatever, and a dip to go with it, you know. And in my opinion, I mean, modern day carp baits, most of them, and apart from the ones that, you know, that are made up using natural attractors, I think most of them, they're just too, they've got too many attractors in them, you know, they're too synthetic, you know. And I always think it's a little bit like someone who doesn't take sugar in their tea. You know, if you give them a cup of tea with sugar in it by mistake, because they spit it out, you know.
Yeah.
They just can't stand that. And I think it's, all too often you hear the stories about, oh, the carp didn't get on the bait for 3 days, you know. You know, people sell all these washed out baits. I mean, do they really think a carp swims around the lake and thinks, oh, I'm going to eat that, it's washed out, it looks exactly the same as, of course they don't. I think a lot of the reason they get caught on washed out baits is because the flavour was too strong in the first place. So always, you know, always bear that in mind for the baits I use. You know, yeah, I have used, you know, real highly attractive, you know, but I normally will use them in a single bait situation, you know. You know, I'm fishing for one carp, he's going to pick up a bait, and he's, you know, hopefully my rig's good enough to hook it. And, but, you know, generally, you know, as I said at the start, rigging the changes, really, you know, using different to what the normal people are using, Having said that, I mean, I suppose when you get a situation where there's a lot of people using a particular type of bait, the fish are, you know, viewing it as a natural food, then you'd be silly if you didn't change to using the same, because you know, I've been on the receiving end and dishing out a number of times where, you know, a group of lads have got a bait going and they're just, you know, the fish are swimming around your bait to get to theirs.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's, you know, just, you know, I mean, so there's no super rig, there's no super bait. Yeah. You know, there's we have to, you know, we have to sort of ring the changes. I have to ring the changes, you know, in order to get a bite sometimes. And, you know, going back to the when we won the world championship in America, I mean, two other members of our team, Tom Duncan Dunlop and George Yonker, however you pronounce his name. They had something like 400 rigs, you know, tied up in readiness, you know, and when Tom said to me, "How many rigs have you got made up, Jacko?" I said, "None." He said, "What do you mean none?" I said, "Absolutely none." I said, "Cause I don't know what rig I'm going to use to on fishing, you know." And he said, "What, you wouldn't like a nice sharp hook, you know, every time, you know, every time you catch a fish?" I said, "Tom, you think about it, we're fishing for a very naive carp using 5 and 6 ounce leads. It doesn't matter if the hook's that ultra sharp, it's going to go in, you know." And I just tie my rig as I go. And I've always done that, you know. You know, if I've ever got into a situation where I'm tying rigs and putting them in a rig bin or a rig box, nine times out of ten, I end up cutting them off to bits at the end of the season, or a few weeks later, to get using components again. You know,
it's so similar to me.
Yeah, so it's, yeah.
I used to think it was laziness, but I think exactly the same. It's interesting what you say about the flavour levels as well. We had John Baker on last week's Normal Carp Cast, and he said exactly that. Those words. He said, "If you need to wash your baits out, then your flavour levels are wrong."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I can always remember Fred Wilton, you know, who if you like, invented the boilie. I can remember a conversation with him even years ago, and he said, "Look, if you smell an individual bait and smell it," he said, "the flavour's too strong." He said, "If, however, you smell the bag of bait and you can detect it, then that," he said, "that's fine." And he said, "You know, they're not getting no nutrition out of the flavour you're putting in it. They're getting the nutrition out of out of what's in the base mix," which at the time was obviously relevant because like milk protein content and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
So he used to use a flavour or essential oil just as a label, you know. But he didn't want to put loads of it in because I think carp can, you know, I mean, we smell things when the smell mixes with air, whereas carp, they feed in a watery place where really it's got to mix with water, you know. So it's more like a taste. And you know, there's loads of baits out there, like things like tiger nuts and things like that. They haven't got no smell, but they get those carp.
Yeah.
So, I think it's, you know, but unfortunately, a lot of the average anglers now, they walk around the shelves and it's got to be bright orange or, you know, or smell to, you know, stink to high heaven before they buy it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily it's changed a little bit over you know, sort of recent, you know, last couple of years. I mean, people have been aware that, you know, some of these baits that don't smell, you know, the freezer baits like mainline sale, etc., you know, things like that, you know, they catch a lot of carp and they don't smell, you know, stink to high heaven.
They were the sounds of Jacko, of course, legendary, and Mr. Lee Jackson. So let's do the last one of these game changers. And let's hear from the people's favourite, Adam Penning.
Greatest edge. Probably the greatest edge. Actually, the greatest edge is one that no one else can, or very few other people can get. And that is what you're prepared to put into your fishing. That is the one thing that will give you an edge over everyone else. So, it's, you know, it's, I know that because I've got a huge amount of stubbornness and I'll just keep persevering, that is an edge. You know, I'm fishing an 8 acre lake, and the other day I did 16 kilometers around it just checking spots in a day, and you think, yeah, actually that's an edge. And I think that's, although I might not be better than most other people, but if I'm willing to put in that effort, it takes my game a little bit higher. So I think that's a massive edge, is what you're personally willing to put into your fishing. Well, it's an edge if you're willing to put in more than other people. Hook sharpening is a massive thing. I mean, I've always been obsessed with hooks. Even when I was back at Drennan, ESP in sort of 96, I used to spend my lunch breaks going through, I'd get all the hooks out of the factory, and I'd sit at my desk with a high power microscope, and I'd just keep grading all these size 4 continental boilie hooks, and I'd grade them all out by eyepiece, and or through this very impressive microscope, and I'd put half in an envelope and post them out to Terry, and I'd keep the other half for my fishing. So I knew it was important then, but didn't have any realization or appreciation that you could actually make a factory hook sharper than what it was. I didn't think it was possible. I thought you would just ruin it. But obviously Jason Haywood showed us all, you know, what was possible and what was achievable. And so then I spent a period of time where I would send hooks to Jason with a check, and he would turn them around for me and post them back all done. That went on for a few years. Then I eventually got the Jag kit. So eventually when it came out, I got the Jag kit and started doing them myself to a reasonable level. And then, so these are all the different stages, I suppose, of my sort of hook sharpening awareness. And then after that, I went fishing with Jim Shelley for quite a lot of years ago now. And he showed me how he did it, which was another level up again above that. And that's how I do it now. So that's a massive edge to be able to do it properly is a big advantage. And the other thing, game changers, I would say probably, I've always had a bit of an obsession with really short hook links. And they've always served me, well, probably not always, I've probably been, but they have served me well on a lot of occasions. I think all things being equal, really short hook link is one of the most potent things that you can have in your armory if it is presentable. But one of the sort of pivotal points in that short hook link process was when I accidentally caught a fish on a short chod rig with a bottom bait. And that led me down a whole new road of sort of discovery of what you could get away with in terms of length with bottom baits on very short stiff links. So that's been a game changer for me, just because everywhere that I've gone, it's just been a bit of a leveler for me. So it's something that I place a lot of faith in, and it's caught me sort of at my English PB, and a fair few others as well. So yeah, those two things I would say.
So as we know, as we're recording this, we're heading for a forecasted snowstorm. For those people fishing that are out on lakes, there's only one tactic in these sort of conditions, I think. While the fish aren't particularly feeding, we're just trying to foul up in midwater, aren't we, Mark?
Well, you'll keep your trebles. Zigs. I'm going to mention this. I told you on the phone, was it yesterday, the other day? I was speaking to Nathan, the owner of Cromwell Lakes. He was telling me, since it reopened after Christmas, it's been hard. It's not done a single bite. You know, it's been busy-ish at weekends, but midweek, you know, not a lot. No one on. So, other than it gives you the run of the lake if you fancy it, it's also given Nathan a chance to have a look round, because I asked him for two questions. He says, what's the clarity of your water like at the minute? He answered, gin clear. You can see the bottom in 12 foot.
Yeah.
Which led on to my next question. Have you been out in the boat and found the buggers then? To which he chuckled a bit. Of course he has. They found them in about 12 foot plus of water, and they're 3 foot down. And it wasn't just the odd one. He said there was a group of about 40 plus fish.
Does not surprise me.
Yeah. And he said, I think almost all of them were 25 plus, and quite a lot of the chunks were there, if not all of them.
Wow. In front of where?
I'm not going to tell you until I've fished it and caught some.
If I had to guess...
It'll surprise you. Go on.
If I had to guess, I would say on the far side, not the A1 side, the other side.
Yeah.
And I would say between Peg... between Windy Point and the other point, Willow Point, I would say between the two, like 60 to 80 yards off the nature reserve, out there in that sort of area around there.
No.
Nowhere near?
No. Peg one.
Really?
Front of Peg one. I'm not sure how far in front, but we know that deep channel that runs down the lake, it starts in front of Peg one. Mm. I found
them there in Peg 1 on the surface. I mean, Peg 1's on the back of the... It's on, we're saying that
on
Peg
the back 1's, of a southerly.
It's on the back of a southerly, on the end of a northerly.
Yeah.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely very interesting. I had me thinking to my... I went down the Folly. I went down for a couple of nights. I only did one because I was just... to be honest, I was starting to get a bit of the sniffles. I wasn't feeling it, so I thought, sod this, I'm going to come home. It's supposed to be enjoyment, not endurance. You know, I had all four, I had three rods, sorry, on bottom baits. So, I should have fished all on zigs and quite high as well, after talking to Nathan. You know, Folly's quite a deep water. A lot of it is around 18 to 20 foot. So why would the fish be anywhere near the bottom? I didn't see any signs of them being on the bottom. I saw no bubbles. I didn't see anything, no fish boshing either.
If you want to know more about the sort of depths that fish... live in, was it episode 3 of the Normal Carp Cast, that Rob Hughes interviews?
Yeah,
he talks about thermoclines and why it is how it is, especially at this time of year, because I think it was in the winter we recorded him, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was back when we very first started, 2 years ago.
Yeah, interesting. So you're going to be out zigging, getting ziggy with it?
I am, 100%. And you know another great thing about zigs?
Mm-hmm.
It's so cheap. You're not throwing 10 quid worth of boilies over each rod.
No, just a blank. Yeah, it's...
just a piece of flip-flop.
Carpcast favourite, Roger Bacon. He was out fishing this last week, and... he went with no bait specifically to fish an area, same thing on the lake that he runs, Deadman's. He knows where the fish are this time of year. All the years his echo sounded it, they're always in the same place, which is in the deepest part of the lake, but you know, half to two thirds up in the water, like kind of off the shelf where they normally catch him from, over the deep water. It's like an old riverbed that runs through it, and it's very deep and silty, and they just seem to sit there. I don't know if the silt gives off heat or I don't know what it is, but they're there every winter. So he went down determined to do 3 nights with no bait, just fish zigs, because he's a bit of a non-believer with the zigs, although he has caught at different times on different lakes, but it's not his first choice method. And he wobbled after 24 hours and went home and got some bait.
Did he catch over his bait though?
No, he didn't, but he did feel better, so that's all that matters. If you want some more zig chat, was it the first John Mack interview where he talks about his winter on Christchurch, where he was really fine tuning the zigs. He was fishing 3 rods on zigs and having them all 6 inches apart. Then the next morning he'd alter them all 6 inches, so he was covering like another 2 foot of the column, the water column. Then he'd change them again, you know, 8 hours after that, and cover another 2 foot until he covered the whole sort of water column top to bottom. And as soon as he found the depth, he was getting the bites out. He was banging them all on zigs, banging them all at the same depth on the zigs, and bish bosh, you know, he had a good few fish. So there you have a listen to the first John Mack interview on the Normal Carpcast. Yeah. So let's move on. Let's go and see.
Don't leave home without it.
Don't leave home without it.
Priority is probably fakes.
Yeah.
I'm a smoker, and anyone who else is a smoker knows that if you ain't got no fags, it drives your head mad. You know, you just got to get some cigarettes. But that aside, you know, it's I would have to say, look, I mean, I've before got to a lake with without having my rods with me. You know, I've left them in the passage or something like that, and you know, and I've ended up spending the night down the lake with some mates anyway, you know, but I'm not actually fishing. But I think that the most, probably one of the most important items of tackle for me is bite alarms.
Yeah.
You know, because it enables me to go asleep of a night, you know. So I've had things where the battery's run out in the bite alarm or an A bite alarm or something. So, you know, you're sitting there fretting and you put a bait runner on and hope you hear it and things like that. But I would say, you know, the bite alarms are one of the most important things. You know, a reliable set of bite alarms, you know, and changing the batteries regularly and all that, because, you know, it enables me to sort of concentrate on the lake rather than sitting there watching the bobbins, you know. Yeah. So I think that's probably, you know.
There's so many young anglers listening to this that won't sort of really, you know, that have been brought up in an era post-optonic where you know, it's, they have a receiver and, you know, they're pretty good, the technology these days, you know, most of the top brands have, yeah, a really good alarm. I mean, back in the day they were called buzzers, and I remember somebody very recently saying to me, why do you keep calling them buzzers? I was like, well, because they used to buzz. You know, it was like you had an arm that got pulled, yeah, over. Go on.
Yeah, that's right. There's still quite a few anglers who've been around for a long while still call them optonics. You know, yeah. It doesn't matter if it's made by Fox, it's made by NASS, or it's made by Delkin, they still call them optonics.
Exactly. And it was such a big deal. I mean, even the first roller buzzers, the optonics, it was such a big deal to actually, you know, had an alarm, because like, obviously with the buzzers, I mean, it was pulling an arm over for the people that don't know and making a contact. As soon as you got a liner or any sort of indication, they kept buzzing until you went and turned them off, you know, because...
That's right. The funny thing is, you know, when I first started carp fishing, using Evren buzzers, I never, I very rarely used to use them. I mean, I've never done much night fishing in them days, but I very rarely used to put the line around the antenna, because my thinking was it offered too much resistance. Little do we know, like in latter years with bolt rigs and air rigs and things like that, that's what we needed to do, you know. And I didn't like all the false beeping and all that. They're so unreliable in comparison to modern day fire alarms, that, you know.
Then again,
if you want to get some little bit of sleep, mind you, haven't said that, you never got no sleep because they get, you know, false beeps and stuff like that, you know.
Exactly. I mean, like I say, people take it for granted now that you have an alarm and it's just going to work when something happens, you know, and then it's going to stop when whatever has happened, you know, if it's a liner, when it stops moving, your alarm stops. And that just wasn't the case, was it, for a long, long time?
That's right.
So when you say your most valuable bit of equipment is an alarm, it's, you would only say that having fished in an era pre-alarms, you know, pre-optonics.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, nowadays, you know, you go fishing and, you know, a bite alarm is so important because it enables you to see what's it like. And you might see something you wouldn't have seen if you were staring at your bite alarms, you know.
Yeah, all those years staring at a butt indicator or a bottle top.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't take your eyes off it, could you? And obviously you weren't seeing fish, so I hadn't even thought of that, but you weren't looking at the lake, were you?
No, it's all
right. Sounds like Jacko was had one too many cigarettes at the end there. But it's interesting about the bobbins and the, you know, not watching the lake. Completely forgotten about that, you know, you used to have to stare at your indicators constantly, sort of pre-alarms, which is an era maybe most people don't remember. But yeah, moving on there, let's go and see what Ian Mack would not leave home without.
So don't leave home without your best item of tackle. Going to have to be really boring. I'm not going to say Ridge Monkey because I'm not eating bread at the moment, which cuts me because I keep seeing all these concoctions in Ridge Monkeys and it makes me salivate as I'm eating me kumquat sandwich or a bloody protein shake. But don't leave home without it, or to the point where I would actually have to divert to a tackle shop to buy both of these products if I hadn't got them. And the first one is obviously polarized sunglasses. And it amazes me that people still spend thousands of pounds on bivvies and rods and reels and alarms and all sorts of things that make their life much more pleasurable while they're on the bank. Yet they don't own a pair of sunglasses or a pair of polarized sunglasses or a decent quality pair. I think some people buy them on fashion more than function. And I have to have the Shimano ones that are quite wide because I've got a massive Swede. And because I can't function without them and I wear them for such a long period of time, if I've got anything that doesn't fit snugly, it actually hurts my head. And now I've lost weight. My trainer calls me Mr. Lollipop Head because he says you've got like a body of a lollipop stick and a massive big yed, which is quite nice. You know, I pay him a lot of money to train me, and then he says, you're like a lollipop or a toffee apple. That's another thing he's called me. So obviously for me, I have to get specific. Not I don't get them made. There's a couple of designs that Shimano do that fit perfectly, and they're sort of the wraparound ones that go down the side of your head so you get no light pollution from the side. And they're so comfy, to the point where I wear them on cloudy days. I've now got a pair of different lenses for them for different light levels, and I must admit, I don't play around that, but I know people sometimes have two or three pairs for different varying light levels, and I don't take it to those extremes, but I just feel naked without them on. It feels really bizarre. Not only do they allow you to see everything and see spots and it takes the glare off the water, but when you're fishing in a big wind and the wind's coming at you, they shelter your eyes, they protect your eyes from particles in the air, from the wind battering your eyelids, and they should be the most important thing that people buy above anything else, because they will just, they'll pay you back so many times over that if you haven't got a pair, then you buy a pair, you'll think, how have I ever caught anything, or how have I survived without not having a pair of polarized sunglasses? Just absolutely the most beneficial item of tackle that I own, I think, and closely followed by Nashi Chodbox. And I've got no affiliation to Kev, whilst I used to have, but this Nashi Chodbox, but let me tell you, there's other people that do these sort of choddy variety things for steaming your rigs. The Nash one is without doubt the best out there, and I've used them since 2007. And there's something about the shape. There's also something about the density of the foam. And because I crimp my choddies, I can get them all the same length or within a millimetre or two. And if you curve, you have to pin them straight onto the chod box, and then you can take the actual insert of the chod box out and steam the whole thing. And for me, I know, you speak to people like Terry and he doesn't have much of a curve in his chod, or you speak to other people and they really, really crank them over. For me, I found that the angle of that foam on that chod box is the one. And not only is it good for storing them, it's good for steaming them to put the actual curve in. Because obviously, once you've got a crimp in it, it's harder to shape with your hands or with your fingers. And I've tried shaping it years and years ago, and they end up like a pig stick. They end up twisted, they end up with kinks in them. And I use the Nashi box because, one, it's the best, and two, it makes my life easier. So why wouldn't you use it? And until somebody does one that's as good, which I don't think anybody ever will, because there's people that have them on tuitions, and obviously in my tuition list, I send the people a list of products to buy, and I always put in there Nash chod box. Now, invariably, people will already have one, whether it's a Corda one or a Fox one or a Solar one. And whilst they're very good, for me, it's none of them are as good as that, because it's just the simplest product that Kev has done, but it's been designed, and the thought process in the foam and the angle, and he's probably stumbled across it by mistake. He probably, knowing Kevin Allen, they've probably gone, well, that's fine. Which, they normally get it very right, Kevin Allen. Well, they have with this one, because it's just the perfect angle, the perfect foam, it's the perfect storage system, and I just think the product is the bollocks. I think it's the best thing for storing and making choddies, which obviously double into a stiff intrigue that it can be. So if I went fishing without my glasses on and I didn't have my chod boxes, which I won't because I'm too meticulously organised, I would either go home or I would go to a tackle shop and buy them, because there's no way I could function without them.
Have you ever forgotten something that you'd divert to the nearest tackle shop and buy it rather than go fishing without it?
I know I've done this several times. It's usually something that, well, I can't actually think of any off the top of my head. It's usually something quite inconsequential, but I'm just like, oh no, I need that, I need that. It's usually something like I broke my last baiting needle or something like that.
Yeah, but I remember when I used to splice a lot of my leaders and stuff, lead core and that. I mean, I use like the leadless core leaders these days, you know, like the Nash, a few companies do them. I use the Klingon leader, the Nash one, but I try and make a load up in advance now. I just make the leaders on their own, because there's nothing worse, especially if it's damp or whatever, and you're trying to splice things on the bank. And as you will know, like, splicing needles are notoriously delicate, so it's very easy to break them. And there's nothing worse than not having a load of leaders made up and like breaking your last splicing needle, which just reminds me I need to order some. But yeah, as far as the having to go to a tackle shop, I mean, Spenny, who I run the Northern Angling Show with, I've been fishing with him on two separate occasions where we've had to divert to a tackle shop to buy him some new alarms, because we're miles away from home and he's forgot his alarms.
How do you forget your buzzers?
Twice that's happened.
Hold on.
To be fair though, I did forget my buzzers. I think I was doing a Carpcast. I think it might have been the interview on Cromwell that I did with
Clifford.
Yeah, I had to borrow some buzzers. But it was because I took them out of where I normally put them. I think I'd packed up differently, just left my rods in. I'd loaded everything else in the vehicle, so the bag that they normally go in, they were separate. When I'd loaded it in my shed, like, the buzzers were not in where they should be. So when I've unloaded to go fishing, and that's the only time I've forgotten anything major like that for about 12 years. I think I've said in the previous extra, I forgot my rods once, but I got to Birmingham from Blackpool, had to turn around and go back when I was fishing Yaley.
How the hell do you forget your rods? It's usually like the last thing that goes in.
Yeah, well, the car looked pretty empty, it was bugging me all the way down there. I knew I'd forgotten something, and then it dawned on me around Birmingham. It's like, that's why the car looks empty. Still no rods in.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Here's one thing I forgot. You know, it was after the first Northern Angling Show. You know, I left early on the Sunday because the Monday I got a tuition booked in. It was on Par Lakes down at Essex.
Mm.
And get all the way down there and I forgot the handles for my barra.
Yeah.
Which was a lot more annoying than it sounds.
It's probably a good idea to not, like, leave home without any of these items. But, yeah, I mean, obviously the hook sharpener's a common one that comes up these days. Obviously, yeah, silly things
in my bag
that you actually forget. But I know there's a comical one coming up from Mr. Chilcott.
Oh, dear, don't go home without it. Right. I don't. Yeah, that'd be my one. Yeah. Sneak your cricket cup down in your rucksack for sure. I wouldn't suggest this is a piece of fishing tackle, but you know, one thing I check every time I go, I've got a bag, a little camouflage waterproof bag. It's got my little diary in it. It's got my little phone charger, power unit, a couple of pairs of glasses that unfortunately I need these days. And in the bottom, and my wife bought me this about 20 years ago, bless her heart, is a little back scratcher that extends. And you can just sit on your bed scratching your back, and it's just an awesome bit of kit. I've had it forever. Obviously, there's the sentimental value, but it gets used every time I go fishing, which is absolutely incredible. Tackle-wise, what would I not go, you know, without? I mean, there's a whole host of things I wouldn't go without, but I have to tell you, I think, oh dear, would I? I don't know how I'm going to use it, because at Fox we're just about to release a whole range of new hooks, and the only hook I've ever had a hand in designing
was the SSC, and it's the one item of tackle I would, you know, stake my very life on. I've caught so many good fish with them, and yeah, along with my back scratcher, I always make sure I've got a good supply of SSC hooks in size 7 and 8. Fantastic hook, and yeah, I'm very proud of it too.
Smith Tackle, you don't leave with that, without it item.
Do you know what? I'm going to, it's not an avid product either. I'm going to talk about two products that, in my opinion, has been the big, in my carp fishing, not in other people's, but in my carp fishing, the biggest two jumps forward is not air rigs or that in the last few years. In the last 2 or 3 years, for me and my angling, the biggest two jump forwards has been the SPOM and what we, yard sticks, you know, wrapping sticks. Because now there's no need to have any spodsville on the bank, which is another plus. It all goes in the right area. The tench hate us because there's no spodsville at 20 yards. And also the rats hate us because there's nothing on the floor now. That, twin that with a set of yard sticks for accuracy, pinpoint accuracy, and the fish. In fact, it's been so accurate in the last few years, it would probably pay you now to be accurate. There's no excuse not to be absolutely pinpoint accurate anywhere you go now, as long as you master them two products. They are... when the SPOM first came out, I laughed my head off. I'm sure most people did. What the hell is this? It's called pineapple, isn't it? It's a pineapple with all the bits cut off it. This huge object that you're going to lob in the lake. How many? You don't even want to guess how many they've sold, mate. And everybody's got 2 or 3 in case you lose one. Brilliant products. So yard sticks and the SPOM for me is the biggest. And I do add, that's my angling. They don't always fit the bill for other people. But in my angling, they've turned it around on certain venues for me, most definitely. Boilies, you ain't got to use a burn stick anymore. Spods are almost redundant, unless you're sloppy spotting. There's no reason to have a spot at all. And we sell them, you know, average sell blooming good spots, but SPOM's the way, isn't it? And, you know, in your accuracy, we'll wrap it around there 20 times. You can't be wrong, can you? You're not chucking legs up trees now. You're not bush, bash, you know. Yeah, for me, them two items are always in my tackle now. Amongst, clearly, lots of other small, you know, irreplaceable items, but they are major step forwards in my angling.
Yeah, I've got to agree with Irvin. The first time I seen a SPOM, I was kind of a bit sceptical, but the first time I actually saw, being marketed your distance sticks, I just thought,
yeah,
get a grip. I've got just two small bank sticks, and, you know, I'm just like you, the old school, like pacing my line out or just putting a bit of, you know, elastic on there. But I've since started using sticks myself, and, you know, I wouldn't be without them. You know, I've become dependent on them.
I'll ask you a question, if I may, Mark.
Yeah, go
on. I'm going to ask you a question now. Just briefly, when you're using yardsticks, and this, I'm interested in your, I truly am interested in your answer. Do you, I see a lot of this in the mags, add this, add that, subtract this for depth and all that. Let's just say you're fishing at 60 yards down 10 foot of water. Do you add some to it, or do you subtract where you think your lead's going to fall?
I guess. Although when I'm feeling the lead down, I try to affect the drop as little as possible, if that makes sense. I'm following it down with the rod forward.
Yep.
And, I might take, maybe a foot or two off for the spod, for SPOM, sorry. But...
yeah.
You know, it is a bit of guesswork, but I do seem to catch the odd one, so...
But I ask you that because I respect your opinion. And I assume we've had him the other year, Mr. Pan in, and we clash a fair bit. He's one of my best pals, so that's not an honourable statement. I love him to bits, Adam. But we can't always have the same ideas. And Adam asked, we were doing a car TV thing, and one of the questions was, Ian, boom, exactly what you just I've just asked you. Do you add or subtract? And I said, well, it's going to upset you, mate, because we always end up arguing about something. But I click everything the same range. I don't worry about mathematics and crap like that. All the time, I mean, bear in mind I'm not fishing 30-foot deep waters. Your average English lake is between 12 and 6 foot. I clip it all the same, and I catch plenty of fish. And he actually looked at me and went, so do I. How boring was that? I was all fired up ready to have a discussion with him. And Adam, I mean, good God, mate, you can't take his ability of fish catching away from the man. If he tells me something, I'll listen to it. You know, and I've done this a great many years. But I've done a tutorial with an ex-chief of police a few years ago. He was mad for all this stuff, computerised stuff and all that. And he said he went out and done this in a lake, and he also done it on a computer, on a graph. And
in water up to about 15 foot deep, it makes no difference whatsoever that you flip them all at the same range. It's perfect. And having already done it in my own mind at that method, shall I say, that was quite heartwarming to hear from someone else who had actually bothered researching, because I haven't got a clue what he was talking about. But I said in the end, is it the same one or not? He went, yep. It all depends how you deal with it when that lead hits the clip. A lot of people, I say, hold them high. I do what you do. I always try and get the lead so it just about hits the clip, just a couple of feet over the surface, and then you carry the rod forward to full stretch, bonk, which is where you started your journey with your lead rod. And that's what I do, and it catches a lot of fish. And I'm pleased to say you do almost as well. You do the same, and that's that.
Yeah, the simpler the better. And I know I've always, if I've actually remembered when I've been wrapping a spud rod up, then if I'm fishing a minute depth, I might have guessed it, but no, down to 15 foot, most places I fish are not that deep. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me at the moment, Horton's 15s and all that, I never take a marker rod now, unless I'm zig fishing or doing a zig tutorial. I mean, you don't need to know how deep it is. So I've got my spud rod with a 3 ounce lead on it, clump that around the swim. When I found what I want, I point the rod at it, clip it, wrap it, boom, wrap me other rod, chuck it out there. As long as I end up with that rod at full stretch where I started with me braided rod, then I'm happy. It's within, you know. And like you, whatever I do manages to catch me carp, so... other than yesterday, of course, but whatever I do, it all goes aside. Catch his fish, over bait or without bait, so it does the job, doesn't it? But yardsticks and the spom for me are two things. They have to be in my bag, even if I don't use them on a trip. I'm seeing a look bait in it. They're there, aren't they? If you need them,
yeah, definitely. And they are a permanent fixture in mine. And I dare say, a good percentage of people who are listening.
Well, I watch, you know, most of my angling, Mark, other than I've started having a little bit on syndicates, as I say, at RK Leisure, but most of my angling, and I really love the fact that this is the case, is day ticket fishing. So I watch. Now, when we've done our yardsticks, a little bit of product pushing here, when John asked me about yardsticks, Tommy Maker had shown me wrapping around bivy pegs years ago. A fair play to Tommy, he was miles ahead of me. I was doing what you was doing, casting next to a marker, putting elastic on it, clipping it up. Job on. Anyway, when John asked me to sort out some yardsticks, I suggested we do them with a swan neck on the top, because I had storm poles like you have, and you have to walk up and down almost with these straight sticks to get your line off of them. With the swan necks, with no bobble on the top like we have with our storm poles, you hold the rod high central to the to these yardsticks, and it peels off superbly. So, but we're still lucky in the trial. I don't understand why this is, because everybody copies everybody. It's not digging anyone out. Everybody gets 6 months out of a product. We've had them years now, and I ain't seen one set of poles, marker sticks, with a curve in the top. So I still think a lot of people are missing the trick. But while they're missing it, we're still selling them. It's one of our biggest selling products of all time at Avid.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I've got a set, and I like that nice really little string you've got in between, with your little bubbles to push along as well.
Well, plus the cover, the colour. Roy Parsons, before he retired, I moved over at Linear, and he said, Russell, these bloody sticks of yours. And I thought, oh, God, what have I done now? Like, you know, my yardsticks? And I said, what's up, Roy? He said, they're growing on my venues. Everywhere I go, there's yellow sticks, which is great because we're doing our job. It's great that people really want them, but it's also, you can see them. Now, he's driven over countless sets of black ones because they blend in with the ground. As he's driving, they don't naturally stick, you know, they don't glow at you. Our sort of golden and yellowy ones, you can see them, so you don't fall over them, Mark. So that was nothing to do with the design of the product. It was because Avid is black and yellow, but it works in our favour. So there you go. No, good products, mate. And there are little nerdy things out there and quirky bits, but then too for me, are mostly what I see used on the bank.
The wrap sticks is a funny one, because there's a lot of old school anglers out there that have got some problem with it. They see it as a... as you know, one of these needless changes in fishing. You know, it's very easy to go, oh, wrap sticks, I've managed for 20 years without them, but you know, why would I need them now? But I agree with Ian Russell there. I think even though it's so simple, I think it's one of the, you know, it's one of the trends for the better in fishing. I mean, it's as important as a marker float to me, and can replace a marker float, because you can lead around with your rod. You can, you know, with just the lead on, so you've got much less disturbance. Quite often you don't really need to know how deep the lake is, you know, especially if it's fairly uniform. You're looking for your clear spot amongst the weed. You lead around till you find it. You clip up, you wrap the spot, and then you know exactly how far to clip your spom rod or your spod. And, you know, you write it down in your little book, make a note of it, and you've got that spot forever, you know, extremely accurately. And when you cast alongside a marker, you never quite know, you know, if it's a rod length behind, 6 foot behind, where it's dropped. You know, I've seen people slate these rap sticks. Oh, I've lived without them my entire life. And it's like, I think you're doing yourself a disservice by not being that accurate. As you know, I've always been a spot angler. Spot fisherman. Anyway, let's move on.
I should have had a bit more of a think about this, but there's several things that I can't do without. Polaroids. You know, I've been 20 or 30 miles into a fishing trip and I've realised I haven't got them, and I've turned around and gone home to get them, because I'd rather go with one rod and Polaroids than no Polaroids and four rods at this time of year. I've got some cocoons that, you know, I've used for quite a few years. They fit over my glasses. Polaroid, I mean, strong arm, solar strong arm line clips. Don't know what it is about them. They just turn me on. I just love them. They fit on your rod beautiful. They do exactly what it says on the tin. They never break. They never go wrong. When a line pops out of one of them, it's just like the most exciting sound ever. Yeah, I love my strong arms. I actually written a whole article in one of the magazines a few years ago on the virtues of the strong arm line clip, because I thought they were so good. So there's some of the. I tell you what, my life wouldn't be the same without a sounder box. As long as I'm not snag fishing or anything like that, it gives me the freedom to check and prime spots here and there. And you know, if it's safe to do so, I'm just going to say this. If it is safe to do so, I'm very rarely in my swim. I'm usually up a tree or, you know, so because I just get bored very easily and I love seeing what's going on. So I couldn't fish without a sounder. I literally could not fish without a sounder box. I heard someone coming along behind me then. There's some of the essentials. I'm sure, you know, then I'll kick myself after this and think, God, yeah, why didn't I say that? There's loads of good ones. Windproof lighters, absolutely, you know, there's times you're trying to flip and blob something or something in, and the wind, you always fish on the ends of the wind. I wish I'd had windproof lighters in my armory 10 years ago. It saved me all this burn, but I mean, the tips of my fingers look like Simon Weston's face, all the flipping accidents I've had with lighters. But so there's that. What else is there? I remember one of the worst things I bought, which is absolutely not a slur on Nash Tackle or anything like that, because I've been told they make some good gear. But back in the day, he bought out a product called, I think it was called Gamma Braid. I remember it's called Gamma something, Gamma Strand maybe, I think it might have been Gamma Strand. But so this is sort of late 80s, and my mate Chief, Nigel Chief Noah R.S. Ellis, he got some of this stuff, and he's coming, he's got, oh, I've got some of this stuff, he said, this is the kiddie, seen the adverts for this in the magazines, we're going to smash it, this is the new Gamma Strand, he says, Kevin Nash Renz, this is the one, he's going to transform my results. So I was like, give me some of that here, put this on, we put on all of our rods. Well, I don't know whether we was doing something wrong, but every carp we hooked snapped it. Just snap, you'd be playing it, it would just, and then you'd wind in and there would just be nothing on the end, and we were tearing it in the end. I remember after losing about five fish, Nigel, he was a right laugh, Nigel, he's got a spool and he's gone, I ain't using this ever again. He's launched it out into the lake. He says, Kevin Nash Gamma Smash, I'm going to call that shit. Again, apologies, this was back in the day and it was probably us doing the wrong knots or something. But yeah, that was something that I wouldn't buy again. But what you said, you thought you knew what I was going to say when we started this. What did you think I was going to say? Hook sharpening kit, yes, definitely. Absolutely. Could not go fishing. I could not it's crazy, isn't it? Because we always used to, but now it's, I perceive it as such an edge, as you clearly do, that, yeah, to go without it, I'd feel disabled.
The hook sharpening kits are such an edge these days. Glad it finally got mentioned. I thought they'd be everybody's number one. Even just the stones that I use, just touching them up after they've been in the water all night. And something I didn't do originally, I've always known since we started sharpening our hooks, that putting some Vaseline or something, it kind of stops that, you know, once you sharpen them, you're taking the Teflon coating or whatever the coating is off, and they do kind of corrode overnight, which again can make them worse than they were before you'd even sharpened them. And but I never liked the idea of putting like petroleum jelly or Vaseline on it, because it displaces the water slightly when you put oil in there, that, you know, maybe it's too fine for the fish actually to be able to tell, but I always had a little bit of an issue with putting that on. But marker pens, you know, like permanent markers, you colour the end in, stops it being super silver and shiny once you've done it, and they just don't corrode again. They're just as sharp when you've sharpened them up. And that's something I know, like the pinpoint kits, they come with marker pens, but I didn't really. It's a great alternative. It's super quick once you've sharpened them, and got to be way better than, as long as you let them dry, it doesn't rub off, and got to be way better than jelly or Vaseline, and you don't look quite as dodgy. Having it's never good when you're out on the bank with a load of lads, carpers, and you know, and they spot a tub of Vaseline in your tackle box. It's, at least it stops you getting took the mick out of with the old marker pens. But I think on the final ones, we're drawing to an end in this one, but I've got Mr. Steve Briggs.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm guessing probably these days people are going to say things like mobile phones and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the answers we've had.
Yeah, but I'm sure it is, yeah. I mean, yeah, we do rely on them so much. Yeah,
too much.
Probably, yeah, I suppose. With my sort of, you know, more continental slant on things, really, one of my main things really would be an echo sounder. You know, it's one item of tackle that actually, if it breaks, I've never forgotten it, but I've had it break on me, and if I haven't got it, I feel not lost without it, but it makes such a huge difference on a session. For just saving time and just learning so much about the swim quickly. Because, you know, years ago, before I had an echo sounder, I just used to see fish jump in and cast to them. And most of the time, I didn't know what was out there, really. Places like Cassian, you know, they're up and down all over the place. And when I got an echo sounder, it like opened up a whole new world, because I would see all these little ledges and drop-offs and high points and snags. And I could literally find out in 1 hour with an echo sounder what would take me, well, probably a week without one. You know, there's so much just drifting over an area, you know, just drift over and see so much that you just wouldn't know was there otherwise. And, you know, there's still only a tool for a job. It's still, you know, you've still got to decide where you're going to fish and whatever. But as a feature finder, if I'm going abroad, that's one thing I wouldn't want to leave behind. That's one of the things I always make sure that's packed.
Thank you to Steve Briggs. Yeah, the echo sounder has just made me think about technology. Are we going to be seeing in a few years' time? Yeah, oh, I forgot my drone. I forgot my underwater submarine. I couldn't see the spots. You know, just thinking 10 years' time, you'd have to drive home to get your remote-controlled submarine.
Now, if that happens, I'll be driving home to get me golf clubs. Yeah. Oh, a little bit of my float rod. I'll be offering hours catching gudgeon on the river.
I'll tell you what, I mean, you know, using drones for spotting fish like from above the lake is probably going to save a few broken bones and climbing trees. I think, you know, I don't think that's a horrendous idea. Or lakes that haven't got trees, you can, you know, just zap that up, and as soon as you get up in the air, you can see everything, can't you? So,
Yeah, I think if I do see a drone flying over a lake, especially if it flies over my swim, I'm going to start carrying a bag of specially air-dried 20mm boilies so I can get the throwing stick out and start peppering the damn things.
I forgot my shotgun for clay pigeon, for clay the shooting the drones.
Yeah, I can see a lot of lakes, there will be a lot of lakes ban bait boats anyway, but I think drone bans will be coming soon, do you reckon?
100%, yeah. I'm sure they're getting used pretty commonly now. You know, there's a chap down Christchurch had one when we were on Lake Bled. There was a guy that had one over there. I mean, it might have been a tourist, to be fair, rather than an angler. But yeah, it's funny, they don't leave home without it. It's probably a different conversation now to what it is in 5 years' time.
Oh, without a doubt. Do you mention echo sounders with Briggsy? Do you take much technology for your fishing other than the obvious, your phone, your bite alarms?
I couldn't live without my phone. I think I would have to go back for my phone if I forgot that.
I'm the other way around. I think I'd enjoy a session without my phone and letting the wife worry about me.
It's just passing the time as well where you're fishing. I fall asleep with podcasts on. I don't sleep well without it. So, you know, and obviously just I don't know if I'd be able to relax, keeping in touch with everything, you know, obviously work-wise. So, yeah, I'm not sure I could be without my phone.
Yeah, your work's slightly different to most.
Yeah. So a big thank you to all of our guests. And they will be back in the next episode with a couple of new questions to ask them all. Have you learned anything today?
I have. I've learned quite a few. Plus, more importantly, I've been entertained. You know, I was entertained while recording them all, but listening to them again, but without having to concentrate, is everything recording right? You know, are we going down the right track? You know, just listening to them in a more relaxed, you're taking more notice, and you're noticing things that you don't hear the first time round. And I've really enjoyed this. I'm hoping our extra subscribers will as well.
Until next time. Turn on. Oh, okay.